or visit nyc.gov/getcoveredNYC. Connect with a Get Covered NYC specialist to see if you qualify for a Medicare savings program. Call 311 and ask for Get Covered NYC or visit nyc.gov/getcoveredNYC.
Stay tuned for Off the Hook here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org online. It's 1 minute past 7 p.m.
The number you have reached, 99.5 WBAI, is now off the hook.
Good evening to everybody. The program is Off the Hook. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you on this Wednesday evening, joined tonight by Kyle.
Yes, right here.
Over in Skype land, we have Rob T. Firefly.
Good evening.
We have Gila.
Good evening.
And we have Alex.
Good evening.
Alex, are you in some exotic place this week?
I guess it's slightly exotic. It's Pittsburgh.
Ooh.
I'm in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
Pittsburgh. Okay, that's great. Wow.
Yeah, I'm here for the National Cyber Forensics Training Alliance Disruptions 2023 conference, and I gave a presentation earlier today, and I'll be here until tomorrow. I was at a Pirates game last night with a bunch of colleagues, and then actually took the weird little subway that they have in Pittsburgh. Have you ever been on the Pittsburgh subway?
No. I'm sorry. I took one look at that and I just couldn't. It's like the Detroit People Mover. It just, yeah, it's nice. You know, it's a concept, but, you know,
yeah.
Call me when you have a bunch of lines and some transfers and, you know, I don't want to sound, you know, all high and mighty here, but it's a city. It deserves a real subway, doesn't it?
I think that's true. I mean, they don't even call it the subway, right? They call it the T. And
that's in Boston. No, Boston calls it the T. And that's, they have a decent system. It could be better, but it's decent.
Yeah, it could be a lot better in Boston.
But Pittsburgh, you've got the 412 area code, okay? And the reason why you're 412 is because when they started inventing area codes, they gave the lower numbers to the cities that were the most important, or at least the ones that you were going to dial the most, so that you wouldn't have to have your finger go all around the rotary dial. So that's why New York has 212, Los Angeles had 213, Chicago was 312, Pittsburgh, 412. We had high hopes.
Yeah, we did. I guess, yeah, right in the middle of the rotary dial there. I didn't realize that the distance that the rotary had to travel determined area codes. I was not aware of that. That's look how much I'm learning tonight.
Yeah, well, I mean, if you look at, things like 907, 808, Alaska, Hawaii, it's way up there. You can just take your time dialing those numbers. No one's in a rush.
Well, it was funny. I was in the elevator with an FBI agent who was from Anchorage, Alaska, and I saw that on his badge. It said, FBI Anchorage. And I said, oh, you're from the 907.
Wow.
And he said, yeah, I am. He said, you've been to Anchorage? You've been to Alaska? And I said, no. I said, but you're in Anchorage, and I'm pretty sure there's an exchange there, 243, right? And he used to have a 907-243 number, and he looked at me like I was some kind of freak. And, so I totally blew this FBI agent's mind by knowing this area code and exchange.
Well, I know how you know the area code. How did you know his exchange?
Well, because way back in the day, when blue boxing was – not blue boxing, when red boxing was a thing, mm-hmm. we used to call numbers in Alaska because it was the farthest phone call that you could make. That was still, by virtue of that wasn't an international call, right? So you could dial 9. So we had to figure out what the exchanges were in Alaska, and we just call up people in Anchorage and talk.
Wow.
Yeah, I know. That's part of my misspent youth.
And, no, actually, I think that was not a waste of time at all. That was some of my fondest memories was, doing similar. I was more of a blue box type than a red box type. And to me, red boxing just seemed too easy. You just hold a box up to a payphone, goes beep five times, and you get a free call. Okay, but blue boxing, you had to route things. You had to, you heard it in the recording before the show. You heard what were known as multi-frequency tones, MF tones. Those are the tones. I describe it to people, in the Pink Floyd song where they make the phone call, those tones. everyone recognizes that. They don't remember the tones from their lives so much. But those were the actual phone company routing tones. And if you could do that, if you could seize a line using 2600 hertz and enter those multi-frequency tones, you could not only route free calls in your area or in the country, you could route all around the world and talk to internal operators and get to numbers that you could never reach otherwise.
Yeah, those were the days. Those were the days. Yeah. If blue boxing was still possible when I was a teenager, I would have done it for sure, but it was a distant memory. I think those analog switches were long gone. We had switched over to the digital 5 ESS switches, and that's all history.
This is actually a very good opportunity to mention something. Kyle and I visited a very interesting place over the weekend. We didn't even know this existed. It's the Long Island Telephone Museum. It's located in the central office in Commack, New York. That's in Suffolk County. And these guys, they're open the first Sunday of every month from 1 to 4 p.m. And it's the most amazing thing. They have all kinds of old payphones. They have all sorts of models of desk phones and key systems. I mean, it blew me away, the amount of memorabilia they have collected. And it is just such an incredibly positive experience to just see all this on display. You can take your time looking it over, examining it, taking pictures. You meet other people that are there for the same reasons. We brought the 2600 van. Within 5 seconds of parking, we had an old guy coming up to us saying, yeah, I knew about boxing back in the day. They're everywhere. We park the van on any corner, and we're going to get people like that walking up. It's great. But Long Island Telephone Museum, their website is believe it or not, longislandtelephonemuseum.com, and all the details are there.
Yeah, I hope they keep expanding, and those places tend to, because the interest is strong, and it takes the kind of curiosity and random visits and support. I know they also probably do like special events and educational tours and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And that's really important because it teaches people about communication systems. And even like Alex said, stuff that's outdated, I think for me it was very instructive and exciting because it made me think about other ways and other systems that I could learn how they worked and have fun with it, tinkering and playing around with them anew in ways that hadn't been explored yet. So that kind of fun with electronic and electromechanical systems that are all around us can be really, really exciting and lead other things too. You can get involved in these places. You can learn more about administering these kinds of systems and all the different types of expertise it takes to run it.
Yeah, if you're a teacher, and I know a lot of teachers listen to us, you can bring your class out to this place, arrange a field trip, and they'll be happy to give you a tour. It'd be most amazing. Yes, Rob?
So you said this place is in a central office. Is this like a working central office? Like, is this still a telephone company place?
It is a working central office, but they have very thick walls between the museum and the actual central office part. Not that there's a whole lot in the central office anymore, because and people might not know this. Every community has what's known as a central office. Usually it's a building that's comprised of brick entirely, might not even have any windows. And it has a logo of one of the names the phone company went by, New York Telephone, 9X, Bell Atlantic, Verizon, you name it. And inside there is the switching equipment for your local telephone exchange. I know a lot of people use cell phones now. You might not even use a landline, but that equipment is still there. It's gone from mechanical equipment, which took up an entire building, to electronic and digital equipment, which takes up a fraction of that space. But the buildings are still there. In every community, there is one. And this one happens to be in Commack, which is on the north shore of Suffolk County. And, they've got a good amount of space devoted to this. There are full-size payphone booths with mannequins inside them, making phone calls, obviously. There are representations of what an operator station was like. Answering machines, old answering machines, huge, big answering machines that you would not believe.
All kinds of tooling and some really good hands-on displays that show you the different types of cable, outside plant equipment, the stuff that it takes to get the calls from place to place. All of that's kind of interesting. Oh, and some examples of modern installations. Old literature, statements, bills, historical stuff that, I don't know, just it has its own sense of, mystique around it. You get this feeling of livelihood of all the kinds of ways people were using this equipment and how, sort of every day it is. We all, use the same kinds of technology or maybe pay the same kinds of bills to this day. Albeit maybe a much greater expense, but just exploring that and seeing how much it has changed and how much it hasn't at all, I think is really fun. There's also a lot of stuff from inside. Like if you never worked in the telephone, conglomerates, I guess any one of the companies or for a large one, or, maybe you had relatives, you realize there's this whole culture within it that is kind of interesting. Awards and achievements. There was a great display of all the pins and various things that would be given to managers and people along the way in their careers and stuff. That's kind of fun to see.
Absolutely. Alex, go ahead.
What I don't understand about this place is that, you know, I grew up on Long Island. I was a phone freak in the 90s. How did neither I nor you guys know about this place until this last week?
I had heard about it before through Newsday, the Long Island newspaper. But it was weird because the story they printed said that the Telephone Museum was reopening after the pandemic. And it was kind of Orwellian because, well, I don't remember it ever being open. I don't remember it ever existing. But I'm just going to accept that there's a part of that history I just didn't know about. They certainly do have a museum there. It is real. It's real equipment, and they know what they're doing. Gila, go ahead.
I was deep diving because I still consider myself the research department. So I was reading some stuff, and it appears that the museum has been closed since before the pandemic. It said reopening after 4 years. So mathing it out, it's been longer than that. I mean, the fact that this is completely volunteer produced is incredible. And, you know, the New Vision pioneers, I'm just fascinated by that conceptually. Like, they're the folks who are running this organization. But yeah, I am baffled that all you people on Long Island had no idea that this was in your own backyard.
No. Don't make it about us on Long Island. All phone freaks everywhere. That includes you guys. None of us knew about this. And, it's pretty incredible. And, but they didn't know about us either. So, you know, it's like we're living in different isolated worlds. They were amazed by the phone company van that we have. But what's even amazing is that they have an even older phone company van. Do you know that, I don't think you guys are old enough for this, but I just had this memory jarred recently, but New York telephone trucks used to be green, used to not have stripes on them at all. It used to be kind of like an olive green. I remember those trucks as a child, but I had not thought about that in many, many years. And I can't find pictures of them anywhere, but, these folks have one. They have one, and it's pretty incredible. It beats the 2600 van.
I just want to add that these places are very hard to run, and this place is growing. So I think it's the kind of thing that it was a chapter for the pioneers, or that it was a meeting space and a place that was collecting things like phones, and the possibility is really, really inspiring, and it takes people checking it out, and we found it was pretty well attended too when the doors were open this weekend. So that itself is a good sign, but it's the kind of place that needs more interest, more building and stuff, and that people will come around projects and get together if someone drops off a big piece of equipment or if they're doing something. More outreach oriented. The place itself attracts that kind of interested, I don't know, affinity group. Mm-hmm. And that is the best part. Getting people that don't know much about it, they're hands-on checking stuff out so that they can tell friends and they can maybe explore stuff. But expanding that makes it easier to work on stuff together, whether it is like a service project in the community or something like building on site as far as like an exhibit or something you can take to have as a spectacle at like other events to promote the place. But it all takes so much to volunteer and put it together. So the fact that they're able to reopen and get people through there is a good sign, because it'll galvanize that in the future.
Absolutely. And there is a connection with the Telephone Pioneers of America, which I believe you had a T-shirt of. You gave a talk at Hope about the Telephone Pioneers.
Oh, yeah. They're a national organization of people that have worked in the telephone industry. And so I believe this was a chapter. The museum itself seems to have an affiliation. I didn't chat them up about it, and I'm sure they could tell you exactly who has membership, but that definitely is I think a group throughout the kind of fledgling national network of telephone museums. They're a strong steering group. Mm-hmm. The types of folks that can help basically guarantee space through like working central offices and come up with people to staff it and lead the tours and so forth.
Alex, you had something?
Yeah, I just wanted to say, you know, it seems like it's not open very often. You said the first Sunday of every month, and it's only open for 3 hours. Is that right?
Well, yeah, but it's open by appointment. If like I said, if you have a bunch of third graders or something that wants to see a telephone, some telephone history, they can make arrangements with you. But yeah, it's a volunteer job. Look, we only have meetings once a month, you know, for about the same amount of time. It takes time, it takes work. The fact that this place exists at all is a miracle.
Oh, I'm in agreement with you there. It sounds like there should be a 2600 field trip there.
Mm-hmm. Well, there was one this past weekend.
Honestly, there were a lot of people there. So check it out if you're in the area, or if you have a telephone museum near you, take some people and just have fun looking at some
and
of the...
And it reminds me of the Telecommunications Museum out in Seattle, which is famed for what it brings to people.
Oh, absolutely. That's kind of what I mentioned, is like these places, you know, every once in a while, the weekends are there, somebody stops by and says, you know, I've got this 5ESS I need to drop off. I don't know where to store it.
They do not.
I got to clean out my garage. Stuff like that happens, and these collections grow over time. So,
well, the difference there is in
it's
in,
incredible.
It's called, what's the official name? The Telecommunications Museum? Is that its name?
Yeah, it's changed names over the years, but the Museum of Communications, History Museum. Yeah,
they have working equipment there where you can actually place calls using old equipment, which is kind of cool.
Oh yeah,
sorry, it's very cool.
It's it's got demonstrations basically. Negative 48 volt power supply from the central office, and then it also connects.
I'll bet they could do that.
Couple phone lines. There's many different teletype and all working Unix systems. Even I could go on and on about that.
And that's also in a central office, right?
Yeah. It's got two floors, and they're basically connected. And the exhibit, you can basically go up and down. Through different displays and see each generation of functioning switch, see it work, see it in like test states, and maybe even some of the working demonstrations. It's got smaller switches. It's got some really, really interesting stuff, but it's been a something that people have been contributing to for a really long time. And it takes a lot of work and a lot of energy to collect that. I mean, they've got an incredible library of all the BSP manuals, which are the Bell System protocols. I mean, just like the microfilm and all the information and history at these places is incredible. Just what people have saved. I mean, it would have been thrown out and dumped if it wasn't taken care of and people didn't appreciate that it has sort of a place in people's understanding of what it took in a corporate sense to in a business sense, right, to have this technological like abundance emerge and then now you know, be what it is today.
I just want to read a couple of lines from their website, then we'll move on to other things. But in many other museums, things can only be seen. In our museum, visitors can handle, listen to, and touch authentic interactive exhibits and artifacts. Long Island Telephone Museum has numerous mannequins and animatronics to showcase our many displays on operations, service, and the history of communications. The pioneers, telephone pioneers of America, founded in 1911 with the help of Alexander Graham Bell, now consist of active and retired employees who volunteer thousands of hours of community service each year. And again, their website is longislandtelephonemuseum.com. And I understand also they have an Instagram account, Long Island Telephone Museum. And the address is 445 Comac Road, Comac, New York. Again, open first Sunday of every month from 1 to 4 p.m. and by appointment. So look them up. Pretty amazing. It makes me wonder what else is out there that we don't know about. Okay, some of the news this week. Last week we talked about how the MTA has abandoned Twitter because Twitter wanted them to pay $50,000 a month for something they were using for free, namely a means of getting a schedule notifications out to the public. MTA felt it wasn't right to be charging $50,000 for the privilege of being able to tell people things like that. And Twitter has now backtracked. A week after announcing it would stop using Twitter to post updates on delays, service outages, and other traveler information, the agency has reversed course after Twitter dropped its demand that government agencies like the MTA pay $50,000 a month for access. The MTA had also earlier said it was worried the service had become unreliable under the ownership of Elon Musk, but officials said Thursday they received assurances riders could count on the alerts. The MTA informed Twitter senior management that it would not pay to provide the public with critical service information. Twitter got the message and reversed its plan to charge the MTA more than $500,000 per year for these alerts. So now no transit agency will need to pay. Well, that's good news, right? So apparently if you speak loudly enough, these companies will hear you and will actually take action or stop taking bad actions.
It's really interesting, though, because so many of these moves by Twitter management, and by that, I primarily mean the really impulsive dude who has been in control of it. They have made so many things that were seen as bad moves, and they're like, oh, yeah, okay, we won't do that then. But they have really lost the trust of people who had grown to depend on this sort of thing from them. So, yeah, they could invite, like, you know, radio stations back on that had decided to leave. They can invite, you know, public utilities back on that had decided to leave. But, you know, when anyone goes back onto the service, they're still under the threat of, like, what if he changes his mind someday and we find ourselves, you know, crap out of luck. And so this is really just, I think, opened our eyes to what it means to depend upon sort of an unrelated third party for information like this.
Absolutely. Now, how do I get my blue check back? That's the big challenge at this stage. But we'll get to that. We'll get to that at some point. Yeah, the craziness continues. Gila, go ahead.
But one thing I did discover is that during the period of time when the MTA was not using the API, a random user, a man named Will Davis, jumped in to use the user-level API, the $100 tier, basically just feeding it straight in from other updates. Sorry, I'm looking, calling it the MTA Alert Bot, pulling data from the MTA's general transit feed specification and basically just doing this in, you know, in the hacker spirit, and was not pulling in bus information because it would have broken the API, but
okay.
At the $100 level, I thought it was a very interesting way that this dude jumped in to kind of stopgap.
Well, how did people get his updates?
They just subscribe to this. I think he's gone. Wait, is it still up? I see it. The second one down there. Has not tweeted in a week, so I think it may have, once the MTA got back on the API, I think he may have dropped out.
Or maybe everything is running on time for a week. That could happen.
It could happen. Tickets to the world where you're living, if that is the case. Mm-hmm. But, yes.
The screen name of this account that he had set up is MTA_alerts_bot.
And did it have a blue check? Because you can just buy them now. Here's the thing. Imagine this Will Davis character was evil, okay, and just wanted to spread bad information, was able to get a blue check, have a username that says MTA in it somewhere. How would you know the difference? You know, the only way you could possibly know is if you looked into the history, saw who had more followers, who was around longer, but you know, the problem with Twitter right now is that there is no actual verification that something is real as opposed to completely made up and bogus. And I don't know how they're going to get that trust back.
Nor do I. And the fact that they're now talking about getting purging accounts that haven't been used in however long.
Mm-hmm.
How I'm, again, thinking about people who used to have Twitter accounts who are no longer living.
Well, you know,
and how we're not going to have a mass impersonation
right.
of dead people.
This is so simple to solve, though. You can have archive sites of people who have passed away. You know, there's simply a way of coordinating that, but they have to take an interest in doing it so that those sites are preserved, not taken over by fake people, not presumed to be inactive simply because the people aren't alive anymore. But at the same time, other accounts, which just were abandoned by people for lack of interest, yeah, they shouldn't just be lying around for 10 years. And, you know, a great example of that is one that we've been trying to get for years. And this is something Elon Musk could actually help with if he was truly interested in this, because the old Twitter wasn't able to do anything about it. But there is the Twitter account called Hope, and we run a conference called Hope, Hackers on Planet Earth. We would love to have that Twitter account. It has not tweeted in years. It's not run by anybody. How do we get it? We've tried, we've asked, we've done all kinds of things. And I just know it's going to wind up in the hands of somebody who is going to squat on it or try to sell it for millions of dollars or something like that. But boy, that would be nice. That would be nice if we could actually get something out of this.
At what cost?
At what cost? No cost. Twitter doesn't cost anything except for your brain cells. All right. Thank you to our program director, Linda, for forwarding this piece of news to us. New York Attorney General Letitia James has secured $615,000 from three companies, LCX, Lead ID, or is it Lead ID? Not really sure. And Efficient, spelled wrong, spelled with an I instead of an E, which I don't know if that makes them any less efficient. But anyway, they supplied millions of fake public comments to influence a 2017 proceeding by the Federal Communications Commission to repeal net neutrality rules. Remember that? We reported on this. Fake comments, lots and lots of fake comments. Now, net neutrality prohibits broadband providers from blocking, slowing down, or charging companies to prioritize certain content on the Internet. An investigation by the Office of the Attorney General found that the fake comments used the identities of millions of consumers, including thousands of New Yorkers, without their knowledge or consent. Collectively, the three companies have agreed to pay $615,000 in penalties and disgorgement. Okay, Alex, I'm going to ask you, what in God's name is disgorgement, and where does the $615,000 go, and how does it help the situation?
Well, the disgorgement essentially means that it was money that they made from the activity that they shouldn't have been performing, and so now they're being disgorged, right? Now it's being taken away from them. This is fascinating, though, because this really confirms what we were talking about several years ago, which we had all suspected, that there was astroturfing of these particular comments. But what's really odd to me, and I'm not aware of this story until you just read it moments ago, what's odd to me is that there are some corporate structures associated with that astroturfing, so that this was some kind of service that people had purchased, perhaps as a massive scale. What would be really interesting to me is, you know, for what else did they provide these bogus comments?
Yeah, that's a great point, because the logical logic might follow that, okay, so who were the clients? Because if that's their business, this might be just a cost of doing business that they're going to write off based on their clientele, you know, already having, you know, foot the bill for whatever activities they were doing.
Can I just read a bit of this press release? Because it really gives an idea how sleazy this was. Basically, this is all part of an investigation by OAG, the Office of the Attorney General. It uncovered widespread fraud and abusive practices surrounding efforts to sway the FCC in the agency's 2017 net neutrality rulemaking proceeding. As detailed in a report by OAG, the nation's largest broadband companies funded a secret campaign to generate millions of comments to the FCC in 2017. These comments provided cover for the FCC to repeal net neutrality rules. To help generate these comments, the broadband industry engaged commercial lead generators that used advertisements and prizes like gift cards and sweepstakes entries to encourage consumers to join the campaign. However, nearly every lead generator that was hired to enroll consumers in the campaign instead simply fabricated consumers' responses. As a result, more than 8.5 million fake comments that impersonated real people were submitted to the FCC, and more than 500,000 fake letters were sent to Congress. I mean, this is, how are people not going to jail for this? I don't get that. $615,000 seems like nothing as a penalty for this kind of fraud. And, you know, the FCC ruled on this, and they did not rule in a good way. Should this be reversed as a result of all this?
Yeah, that's far as charges.
Yeah, I agree. I agree with Kyle. I mean, $615,000 does not seem like a success story here for the Attorney General, I have to say. I had no idea that they actually concluded that the clientele were the broadband companies here that actually profit from the repeal of net neutrality rules. This is totally insane. I mean, this should be a much, much bigger story.
Yeah, it sounds like they were insulated by having contracted them. And I mean, to that end, it sounds like they got away with it.
Sure does.
Straight up, because we know how the FCC ruled.
Yeah, I mean, the only way in which I think that would be a reasonable conclusion of this investigation would be if the broadband companies contracted with this lead company, whatever it is, this corporate entity that provided essentially astroturfing as a service, and the broadband companies had no idea what they were doing on their behalf. But you do have to assume some responsibility for the actions of your agents, right? I mean, you hired them to do something. What did the contract say? What was it that they thought they were going to be doing? And was there any auditing? I mean, I'd love to see the communications about this at the time, because this really does seem like an issue of public trust. Mm-hmm. And if an agency action was predicated on those comments coming from what they thought were real people, then the agency action, to me, seems to be invalid. I think there would be grounds to bring a lawsuit alleging that the agency action was, in fact, arbitrary and capricious or not predicated properly.
Yeah, it doesn't seem nearly strong enough, as far as I'm concerned. A reaction to this should be outrage, not just on the part of the Attorney General, on the part of all of us. You know, this is outrageous. And yeah, you're right. It should be much more in the news. It should be headlines in every newspaper. Go ahead, Rob.
It should definitely be much more in the news. But about this $615,000 not being enough punishment, I think if you look at it as this was the Attorney General of New York getting it back for the New Yorkers who were affected by this. And there are 49 more states in the union with their own attorneys general who can now follow suit, so to speak. And so if this piles up, if more states take the lead on this and follow up, this could turn out to be a lot more of a punishment for them.
Have you seen some of the attorneys general attorneys general in other states? They're too busy fighting the trans community and making sure nobody ever gets an abortion again to care about people actually being defrauded in this manner. But, you know, my hopes are high, but realistically, I don't know. Okay. Well, we have this update for Google. You know, if you try this, folks, if you go to Google News, right, as a technology section, I just tried this a little before the show.
I know about that section.
You know about that section? Okay, yeah. So you get a bunch of technology headlines, maybe six of them, but you can click on the word technology, then you get a whole lot of stories.
Yeah, that's all of them.
But I noticed that the first, like, at least 10, maybe a dozen stories are only about Google.
Yeah.
Have you noticed that? And then below that, there's nothing about Google. It's all Apple. It's all Twitter. It's other companies. Well, but they really put themselves up on top. Now, I don't think that was a coincidence.
No, not at all. I mean, this section in general for, like, news, I've found it's hard to take. It really is. It's a lot. It's all sort of industry self aggrandizement or something. Like you said, it's these four companies. It's very highly concentrated, just certain types of technology, and that's it. And I feel like it really narrows what technology is. I find, and in fact prefer the science category over technology.
Oh, yes. Absolutely.
It's just so commercial. Like just one company, the very company that you're using this news filter on.
Yes, Rob.
Yeah, I pulled it up just now, and you know, even allowing for different people getting different Google results, because that's how it works now, the first 8 results on this page are Google's releasing this, Google's producing that, Google's doing this. Uh-huh. Isn't it great? And the 8th story is not about Google. Instead, it's about Elon Musk slamming Meta's WhatsApp. So it's not about Google, but it's about how terrible their competition is.
And look out for Android, too. Sometimes an Android story will slip in there, which is also Google.
Yeah, after that, the 9th story is now about a vulnerability in Windows. So,
but it's a vulnerability. Again, it's something bad. It's not Microsoft is releasing this. And I'm not saying Microsoft needs any more positive platforms, but I think this is kind of an abuse of a news aggregator.
Well, and you're so focused on your own brand, it seems like you could maybe reserve that for what everybody else is doing, you know, that make it kind of fresh, like people that might see a lot of Google stuff because you're in that ecosystem. How kind of eye-opening would it be to just maybe not have so much of that in that particular section, so you can compare, so you can see what the rest of the so-called technology category is up to.
You know what I prefer, though?
Stay informed.
Google's busy. They have all kinds of things going on. Everything's simmering on the oven there.
They're important.
Let's take, you know, they don't have to do this. Let's instead have another company come up with a news aggregator that does a better job than Google News. Because, boy, Google News has become so useless. Every story you click on, they want money to read. You know, you can't subscribe to every newspaper in the world. So what is the point of having an aggregator that shows you all these stories you could read if you were a subscriber to that particular newspaper? Used to be that if you went there through Google News, that you'd be able to read the story. That was the whole point. And now it's kind of pointless. You can see the headlines, not much more.
Subscribe to a newspaper. You don't have to subscribe to all of them, but maybe like a local one that
you got
a soft spot for.
Especially a local one. Absolutely. Yeah, those
if
are...
everyone did that, you might have a lot more free stories on Google.
Mm-hmm. Subscribe to a newspaper that you believe in. Let's say the Washington Post or the New York Times or somebody you think is, you know, maybe they do a bad job occasionally, but mostly they do a good job. But also something local that covers your community, that's run by human beings. That's run by human beings that basically you're supporting them rather than just looking online and having, you know, artificial intelligence do it. Because that's what's going to happen. Alex?
I mean, I think you can bring this right back full circle to the Long Island Telephone Museum, because apparently you guys learned about the museum from Newsday.
Mm-hmm. That's true. Yes. So yes.
There you go. There's the cause and effect.
Anyway, the story I wanted to read about Google, I'm glad we took that long to get to it. They are announcing major generative AI-powered updates to their search engine. Now, what the hell does that mean? Well, it means that Google is now moving its Bard artificial intelligence entity into the Google search bar. So, according to this particular story,
how do we even know Google is in control of that?
We don't.
Maybe Bard just decided it was taking over.
This could be
search.
Straight from Bard, yeah. But this story, which came from Yahoo, or a bot that works at Yahoo, says that if you search for something like "good bike for 5 mile commute with hills," search will then provide you with the generative AI page, which will provide you with a list of suggestions for things to look for when searching for bikes for commuting. And below that, you'll see potential follow-up questions you can ask, which will pull you into a conversation panel, complete with the ability to link directly to bike retailer websites. During a live stage demo, Bard pulled up answers for "why do whales like to sing?" The app quickly provided a list of potential reasons for why whales sing, provided images of whales, and allowed the user to ask follow-up questions. Google is positioning generative AI as a future of search, and as the company's most important product and largest revenue source, it's no wonder it's moving fast to add the capability to the platform. Yeah, this is going to be interesting. You're going to be pulled into a conversation every time you ask a question now in Google. It might even remember previous questions that you asked. So, I don't know. Good, bad, scary? What do you guys think? Do we think anything? Anybody?
Look, I think it's inevitable, right? I mean, I think this is something that Microsoft had been already putting in place, and I think that we see Google getting really scared about this. So I think that they're rushing to get Bard connected into the search engine too, because people's conception of what it means to search for information on the internet has really changed over the last couple of months. I mean, since the beginning of 2023, when we started talking about ChatGPT and all that it's been up to and all the amazing things that you can do, and I think maybe it wasn't even the beginning of 2023. Maybe it was the last quarter of 2022 when things started to really change. But if you think about it, and we've talked about this in the past too, but you do a search for anything on Google and you have to scroll through, you know, a whole bunch of paid advertisements that nobody trusts anymore. Some of them might even be malicious. Some of them are definitely misleading. And it does seem like, and I'm sure Google feels like, their search engine is quickly becoming outdated. Mm-hmm. So they have to migrate over to this natural language searching and still have the veneer of a technology company that's on the cutting edge. And they can't do that without plugging into the Bard system. So I see them doing this as almost as an emergency measure to save the relevance of Google searches. But I also wonder about whether it's premature.
I kind of hear that, like, it may be, like, too early, the whole diving in to it. But there's another thing that I'm getting out of this. I think it's sort of overdue and appropriate. Like, it is the technological tool that I think people are... that we have been using in a way that this evolution is really conducive to. Like, natural language in search, people have been talking to Google as though it was sort of AI or sentient. I mean, maybe not without all the, like, arguments and pluses and things that you can do to sort of guide Google to give you better results, which there are things, you know, ways you can type and enter. That's an entire field of study we could go off on. But the point is, now it's sort of here. It's actually here. And whenever I actually it's just, to me, a good fit. And I think they were pushed in a lot of ways by Microsoft, maybe because of their own cautiousness. So, in other words, maybe what we think might be rushed has actually been a long, long time coming from the inside looking out. As far as product development goes. So there is kind of an excitement that I have for this at the same time, you know?
I got to say, though, as far as artificial intelligence, search results and explanations of various things that you ask it, I think Bard is lagging. I really do. I think ChatGPT is doing a much better job. I just asked Bard right now, briefly, tell me the history of WBAI. It got so many facts wrong. It said WBAI's first broadcast took place on May 1st, 1955. Well, it didn't. It took place in 1960, I believe in January. It just made up a date. Yeah, and get this. Here are some programs that have aired over WBAI. Democracy Now, okay, they got that right. The Lionel Hampton Show, jazz program hosted by Lionel Hampton. Lionel Hampton do a show on WBAI? I mean, if they did, I didn't know about it. The Takeaway, a daily news and interview program hosted by John Hockenberry. I thought he was on NPR. but you'll see things like this all the time where all kinds of things that sound right, they sound credible, but they're wrong, they're fake, and yet it's presented as truth. And I just worry that people are going to start believing this. And you can basically ask any question. For instance, I was asking for a list of monarchs in the United Kingdom in the 19th century. And I was told there were none. And I know that's not true. And I even confronted Bard about this, saying, "But look, this person was a monarch. How do you explain that?" And Bard said, "Oh, I made a mistake. I'm sorry." that's not good enough, because it continues to do the same thing even after you've corrected it. So it's going to be a very interesting adventure that we're all embarking on right now. I'm all for embarking upon it, but let's not take it too seriously. Let's realize what we're getting into.
Yeah, and I think because it could become very close to home. I mean, how long before your home assistant device is asking Bard questions or somehow fused with it, and all of a sudden you're having this much more powerful conversation with your home assistant device. You can see the pathway. I mean, Siri on your smartphones and so forth. So there's a lot of stuff here that is been sort of sizzling, and it's now the foundation for something anew.
Okay, so this weekend is Eurovision. I don't know how many people in the United States know this, but Eurovision is an annual song contest. Experts from the National Cybersecurity Center have been called in after the government and Eurovision organizers raised concerns that the competition could become a digital front of the Ukraine war. If you recall, last year Ukraine won the contest, which meant that the contest should have been held in Ukraine this year instead of being held in England, because obviously you don't want to have Eurovision in a war zone. A senior Whitehall official said the biggest worry was the potential hacking of the voting system, like last year when police in Italy, where the contest was staged, said the KillNet hacker group targeted the first semifinal and the grand final. This year's contest will be held in Liverpool. It will have reinforced cyber defenses by NCSC experts working with the Home Office and the Department for Science. In 2022, Italian police managed to thwart attacks by pro-Russian hackers at the competition in Turin, especially during performances of the Kalish Orchestra, which represented Ukraine and won the contest. We are actually going to go out with that particular song from the Kalish Orchestra, the winner of last year's Eurovision. This year's Eurovision contest will be held in Liverpool, I believe on Saturday, the final, which I'm pretty sure you can watch on YouTube. Not entirely certain about that, but it's a lot of fun. It really is. Music might not be your cup of tea, but the enthusiasm certainly is something we can all get behind. And next week, maybe we'll play the winner of that particular contest. We're coming back in just a few minutes over on YouTube. Go to channel 2600 or simply click on the link on the 2600.com webpage. It's your opportunity to give us a call if there's something you'd like to talk to us about, or to just hear our voices for another few minutes. You can write to us, oth@2600.com. And you can tune in again next week at 7 p.m. on WBAI for another exciting broadcast of Off the Hook. But again, at 8 o'clock, we will be on YouTube, channel 2600, for overtime. And now, from Ukraine, last year's Eurovision winner, the Kalish Orchestra. Good night. Stefania, mamo, mamo, Stefania, розквітає поле, а вона сивіє, заспівай мені. Мамо, колискову, хочу ще почути твоє ріде слово. Вона мене колисала, дала мені ритм, і напевне сило волі не забрати мене подала. Вона напевне знала, може більше і відсола. Мона ломаними дорогами прийду я завжди до тебе. Вона не розбудить, не будить мене сині бурі, забере бабулі, звідулі, ніби вони кулі. Дуже добре знала мене, не була обманута, їх було дуже втомлена, гойдала мене так.
WBAI's local station board, the Pacifica Foundation Board, responsible for local management and operations, is holding its next regular meeting on Wednesday, May 10th at 7 p.m. As events unfold within the Pacifica network and multiple stations cope with financial weakness, it's important for the LSB to identify and keep up with what local priorities should be. We're working to ensure that a robust WBAI 99.5 FM remains where the 99.5% can find it on the dial. Again, the LSB meeting is Wednesday, May 10th at 7 p.m. The meeting will be held through the Zoom remote meeting service. The meeting, accessible to the public, includes an opportunity for public comment. The fastest and easiest way to join the meeting is by using the link on the Pacifica calendar at kpftx.org and on the WBAI website. You can also access the meeting by calling 929-205-6099. That's 929-205-6099. And enter this meeting ID, 922-457-2995. Meeting ID again, 922-457-2995. And as if that wasn't enough numbers, we also have a password. The password is 995, like BAI's frequency. So it's 995-995-99. Do you have to contribute to WBAI to access the meeting? No, but we sure hope that you do. 212-209-2950. To support WBAI in New York City.